Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of The Diary of Ellen Rimbauer, My Life at Rose Red, edited by Joyce Reardon, PhD, narrated by Alexandra O'Karma. This recording is copyrighted 2002 by Recorded Books. From Joyce Reardon, Department of Paranormal Phenomena, Beaumont University, Seattle, Washington. Dear reader, in the summer of 1998, at an estate sale in Everett, Washington, I purchased a locked diary covered in dust, writings I believed to be those of Ellen Rimbauer. Beaumont University's Public Archive Department examined the paper, the ink, and the binding, and determined the diary to be authentic. It was then photocopied at my request. Ellen Rimbauer's diary became the subject of my master's thesis, and has haunted me ever since. Excuse the pun. John and Ellen Rimbauer were among the elite of Seattle's turn-of-the-century high society. They built an enormous private residence at the top of Spring Street that became known as Rose Red, a structure that has been the source of much controversy. In a 41-year period, at least 26 individuals either lost their lives or disappeared within its walls. Ellen Rimbauer's diary, excerpts of which I offer here, set me on a personal course of discovery that has led to the launching of an expedition. Shortly, I will lead a team of experts in psychic phenomena through the doors of Rose Red, the Rimbauer estate, in an effort to awaken this sleeping giant of psychic power, and to solve some of the mysteries my mentor, Max Bernstein, was unable to solve before he went missing in Rose Red in 1970. I never met Dr. Bernstein, but I consider his writings the most progressive in the field of psychic phenomena. Many thanks to my publishers, Beaumont University Press. I hope the publication will widen the public's perception and acceptance of psychic phenomena, and firmly anchor a fascinating historical period in the growth and expansion of the Pacific Northwest. I have taken great pains to edit this document to a readable size, deleting the repetitive sections and omitting those I found offensive. For the extremely curious, or the voyeuristically minded among you, a portion of those edits can be found archived on the World Wide Web at www.beaumontuniversity.net. Photos of the house can be viewed on the website as well. Good reading. In the name of science, I will pursue the truth of Rose Red, wherever it may lead me. Sincerely, Joyce Reardon, PPA, MD, PhD. And now, The Diary of Ellen Rimbauer. The following are excerpts taken from Ellen Rimbauer's diary, dated 1907 to 1928. Any and all editing has been done at my discretion. Some effort has been made to protect the integrity of Mrs. Rimbauer and her descendants, though never at the cost of content. What follows are the words of Ellen Rimbauer, in her own hand, with as few editorial comments as possible. Joyce Reardon, November 2000.
April 17th, 1907. Seattle. Dear Diary, I find it a somewhat daunting task to endeavor to place my thoughts here inside your trusted pages. I scarcely know if I'm up to the task, but as my head is filled with lurid thoughts and my heart with romance and possibility, I find I must confide in someone, and so it is to your pages I now turn. I have lived these 19 years in full premonition of that time when a man would come into my heart, into my life, and thrill me with love, passion, and romance. That time has now come. I swoon just thinking of John Rimbauer, and some of my thoughts are not at all becoming of the lady I am expected to be. My physical desire does at times possess me. Am I influenced by my reading of popular novels, as my mother is wont to say? Or am I sinful, as my father has implied? No, not with words, but by branding me with his raised eyebrows and scolding brow. I must admit here, too, to the simultaneous impression that danger lurks within arm's reach. Death, dread, destruction. Born of guilt, I wonder, for the unladylike fantasies to which I succumb when alone in the dark? Or is the source of these images something, some force entirely exterior of myself, as I am prone to believe? Does another world exist? For it seems to me it must. A force apart from human experience. A power all of its own. And not one familiar with the God to whom I pray. Something darker, external, otherworldly. Something altogether unknown. It lurks in the shadows. I feel its presence. I would be lying here if I did not admit to a certain thrill this looming sense of the future, of the unknown, affords me, both the unknown of what John Rimbauer's touch might bring to my life, as well as this sense of a larger, darker force at play. John Rimbauer is a partner in a large oil company, Omicron Oil, along with a Mr. Douglas Posey, an affable, quiet gentleman whose company I've had the good fortune to keep, along with that of his wife, Phyllis. Oil, I'm told, holds great promise as a fuel for lighting homes, and perhaps someday even heating them. John says that oil water heaters for the home are all the rage in the East. Kerosene is being used in motor cars. I hope someday to perhaps take the train with John back to Detroit, where he does business with the Rockefellers. Oh, but my head spins with such fancy. Dinner with John D. himself, a banker's daughter from Seattle, Washington. And yet, I sense the world is about to unfold at my fingertips. John is the key to that world. I feel certain we are to be engaged within the month. Dare I say that with such honesty? Only here in your pages, dear diary. John has ordered the construction of a grand house, grander than any house in all the state, perhaps in all the land. He tells me of it often, as if it is to play a significant role in my life as well, which I now feel, nearly, certain it will. I am blushing as I write this. He has offered me a motor car ride to the construction site, and I have accepted. Within the week, we shall ride together to what may prove to be the site of our future happiness together. One hopes for happiness. This dread I feel, will it too play a role? I can only hope and pray that this sense of impending doom will be overcome by the light and love my future husband and I shall share. May 11th, 1907, Seattle. With trembling hand, I find myself reluctant to record in your pages the horrible events of this day. Several weeks have passed since my last entry, weeks given to one delay after another, brought on by John's business affairs, or so I'm told, my own infirmity, a woman's monthly ritual of roses, as my mother refers to it, and John's apparent inability to arrange a convenient time for the two of us to visit the construction site. At last that time was set, for today, this very day, and I awaited John's arrival on the front steps of my family home with what can only be described as a beating breast. Such anticipation! Much to my disappointment, and to my mother's too, all things confessed, an offer of betrothal has not been received. Certainly not by me, nor has John approached my father. My mother has informed me in the strictest of confidences, with any discussion of dowry. My, but the weeks have crawled by slowly. Twice I've been told by trusted friends that John's motor car, or one just like it, was spotted late at night, on the high road between the city's loading wharfs and the hill where John currently makes his residence. I am confident that these excursions can be easily explained by the importing of barrels of oil to those wharfs, as this happens at all hours, night and day. But of course, a tiny part of the woman in me fears another truth altogether, as that part of town is known for its debaucheries. Who is this man I hope to marry? I scarcely know. My fears have found their way into my prayers, and I find myself in sin, making silent requests to the powers that surround us to punish John Rimbauer if any transgressions be known. Just last week, as I made such a dark prayer at the side of my bed, an enormous wind, quite like nothing I've ever seen, took wing and delivered not only a branch, but an entire tree to my window, shattering glass and throwing debris as it was ripped from its roots. Oddly, no other tree in our yard was affected, nor did any neighbor report any such wind. I attribute that reckoning to the very substantial power of prayer, though my mother calls such reasoning foolish, despite her being a woman of Christ. Dear diary, let me tell you this. If that tree had anything whatsoever to do with my prayer, it had nothing to do with Christ. On that evening, neither Christ nor God were in my prayers. Oh, faint of heart, dare not read on. For it was to him I prayed. The other him. The other side. For if transgressions have been made, then John Rimbauer has already switched his allegiance, whether aware of it or not. It is to his power that I pray. I have taken a moment to lock the door. I am staying these nights in my sister's room while repairs continue to my own. Increasingly, I feel as if someone is reading over my shoulder as I write. John? My mother? I know not. But it is a disturbing notion, and one that requires of me certain precautions to which I have now dedicated myself. I not only lock the binding of this diary, but I secure it safely in a locked drawer as well, the small keys kept around my neck and hidden down my dress, on a silver necklace once worn by my great-grandmother Gilchrist. Certain small oddities, events unexplained, continue to perplex me and drive me to these precautions. Just yesterday, my hairbrush switched sides of the sink, all of its own, as I ran water on my face. I swear it's true. I lifted my head to find the brush available to the left hand, when only moments before it had been held in my right. Some furniture has been found out of place. One of my dresser drawers stuck yesterday, the one bearing love letters from John, and would not come open, even under the efforts of Pilchard, our butler. Today, I'm told, Pilchard will remove the back of the dresser in an effort to reach the drawer's contents. If taken individually, not one of these small events would matter to me. But collectively, are they to be ignored? I find myself both terrified and thrilled. So perhaps I am to blame, not only for my sinful prayers to the other power, but for my innate curiosity and fascination with the otherworldly quality of these apparently disconnected events. The devil's due, do you suppose? But wait. To the events of this day. John Rimbauer picked me up this morning at 10 a.m. in an automobile made by Olds. It is one of only a few such vehicles in all the city. The buggy was quite loud, and the experience altogether exhilarating, though bumpy and somewhat terrifying at times. John drove, I believe quite well, though who am I to know? West on Spring Street, to the site of the construction that preoccupies him. The trip consumed some 15 minutes. The house is to be built atop a hill that overlooks the city. Twice I was nearly thrown out the side, or so I imagined. John assured me I was safe all along. John Rimbauer, ruggedly handsome, is a pragmatic man, which possibly accounts for his success in the oil business. Extremely sure of himself, and even given to moments of conceit. He remains calm in the face of adversity, whether a four-horse team blocking the road or a storm on the high seas. John is extremely well-traveled, having visited Asia, the Americas, and Europe. I find his strength both comforting and disarming, in that John is often an unpredictable mixture of tolerance and intolerance. I have never been on the receiving end of his ill temper, but woe to those who are. Of course I don't wish to be, nor will I tolerate such ferocity directed at me or our children. Just the thought of children floods me with a keen, passionate warmth, the likes of which I've only read about in my novels. Perhaps Mother is right. I should like to relate here my recollection of an exchange we had on the trip over. "John, dear," I said, "do you suppose I should have offended my mother by my refusal of a chaperone?"
"You're a grown woman of 19, Al."
"I love this nickname for me he has chosen."
"Your mother was married and with her second child by the time she was your age. I doubt very much you could do anything to shock her."
"You don't know her as I do," I said.
"I am twice your age. I should imagine that concerns your parents, especially as to my intentions."
He lowered his eyes to me, running them down the full length of my dress to where I felt faint. He understands full well this power he has over me, uses it playfully. But on this occasion, and there have been others, truth be told, it was not so much playful as provocative, and he made no effort to disguise or conceal his lust. I felt certain of it at the time. And what was I to do? I giggled, all nerves, of course, blushed, no doubt. I felt the heat in my cheeks. But I kept my chin high and my eyes on the muddy road ahead. "And what are your intentions?" I asked, suppressing a smile.
"To ravish you, of course. To pluck your innocence from the vine of youth and leave you for the next man to marry."
"And my father will come after you with axe and rope."
"And you? Will you refuse me?"
"Your so-called ravishing, of course, until we are married."
"Engaged or married?"
"We've had other fun, John Rimbauer." Certainly I must have blushed again, for I felt it in my face. "We had touched. We had kissed. His strong hands knew the shape of my bosom, though never skin to skin. Once, while dancing, he had pressed himself to me, and I had known of his arousal. But he had yet to know of mine. Mother's cautions of a lady's behavior fell flat on my ears. She lived in another time. All the girls talk of touching their men, of pleasing them, if for no other reason, in an effort to quell their desires and protect their own virginity, that most sacred of marriage rites. John's age, perhaps, has accounted for no such need on my part. He is experienced.
I treasure his worldliness, and believe it affords me much opportunity.
And more to come, he said. I trust we both will find.
He searched for his words.
Great reward in marriage.
John, I blurted out, like some sniveling 12-year-old. Marriage?
Patience, my dear. Never push me. Never challenge my decisions. If you hold to these two virtues, we will never have a single quarrel, you and I. I am lord and master of my house. I have worked long and hard to earn not only a small fortune, but the right to stake out my own territory. And that territory includes opinion. You understand that, don't you, dearest?
Yes, John.
No reservations?
None.
Because I am well aware of suffrage, and have no quarrel with a person striving for individual freedoms, more power to them. But not in my home. You understand? You will find I can be a most generous, most loving partner, my dear. But just ask Mr. Posey what happens when my partners betray my trust or break agreements. I am offering you many things in sharing a life with me. Freedom is not necessarily one of them.
John Rimbauer, are you proposing marriage to me? This, I fear, is all I was thinking, all that I heard. Only now, as I write down my recollection of events, only now, as I recall those words of his clearly, do I feel their full import.
Patience, my dear. Patience.
A smug smile. I felt for sure I knew what this day held in store. As it turned out, I couldn't have been more wrong. Neither John nor I could have possibly foreseen events as they were about to unfold. The property John purchased to hold his mansion, his grand statement of achievement and success, is nothing short of spectacular. It is crowned with a tall forest of cedar and pine, and workers have cleared nearly 6 of the 40 acres to hold the house, if something so large can be called that. I could not believe the plans John showed me. Though well out of the city, the house sits at the muddy end of Spring Street. From this location, one can see the entire city below. Spectacular! Just west of the property is a tract that I'm told runs all the way to Canada and south as far as Mexico. How my imagination runs wild with the thought. One road spanning the entire country. Just think! The redwood forests, San Francisco, Los Angeles, where they are now making films. Not quite 2 years ago, when a traveling projectionist brought it to town, I saw Le Voyage dans la Lune, A Trip to the Moon, adapted from the novel by Jules Verne. I loved this book. The film was 15 minutes long, the longest ever made at the time, and was shown at Father's Bank, of all places, because it had the largest white wall that could be found. I adore motion pictures, simply love actors and actresses, and hope that John and I will include them as our guests when we make our home together. But I'm getting ahead of myself. The property is accessed from the west. John parked the Olds quite some distance from the construction. A gigantic hole in the ground is all. And, bless his heart, had had workers lay a string of redwood planks wide enough to walk upon, so I might avoid the mud and ooze. Horse-drawn wagons came and went, burdened and brimming with materials ordered by the foreman, Williamson, a big Irish-looking man with florid cheeks, a broad mustache, and a surly disposition. He did not appreciate a woman being on the premises, I can tell you that. He made several insinuations upon my arrival, that is, until dear John led him aside by the elbow and had words with him, after which he ignored me with full contempt, though was loath to outwardly reveal his disapproval of me. I can only wonder now if this brief altercation with my beloved, an altercation that resulted from my attendance there, had something to do with the events that would soon transpire. Oh, good Lord, pray let it not be so. Nay, do not curse me with the burden of lost life. I am forced to wonder now about my musings put forth in my first entry to these pages. Was what happened today at the grand house the sense of foreboding danger that I felt so strongly? The end of it, or just the beginning? The manifestation of some dark power greater than can be imagined? Am I a part of this darkness, or separate from it? Controlled by it, or instead by my prayers? The pen trembles under my grasp as I search for these answers. Am I, in fact, already possessed? Dare I think that? Dare I write it? Dare I keep it to myself, for fear of spoiling the arrangements already underway between my beloved and me? But, oh, there I go again. Back to the day and the tragedy that befell us. The cavernous hole cut into the earth on that forested slope, so far from the warmth of my family home, forewarns of a structure, in scope and size, that challenges even one's imagination. I admit fully that I had never visited any construction site prior to my journey this day, and that, perhaps because of this lacking, I write with what borders on ignorance. But I am no stranger to architecture, I promise you that. Furthermore, I now intend to immerse myself in the study of this science, along with that of construction, so as to appreciate fully the efforts being undertaken on our behalf. The sheer enormity of it! I can only hope this does not match my future husband's ego or conceit, for if so, I am in for a formidable challenge in the years that lie ahead. To my eye, it rivals in size the university building that occupies the hill to the south, overlooking the city, that building that newcomers nearly always mistakenly attribute to be the State House. I believe John's house, our house, will dwarf this structure by such proportion as to render it insignificant, will so dominate that clearing where it will stand that it may be seen for miles. Miles, I tell you. A landmark for generations to come. Why, the hole in the ground, the foundation, is a marvel of excavation. I watched as four mule teams carved and cut the thick, wet soil with blades, followed by workers busy with shovels to fill wagons. Wagon after wagon, hour after hour, and barely a dent in the giant cavity. The scale of this project defies description. I can only say that nothing like it has ever been built. Perhaps, even, that nothing ever will be. The event of the day, to which I wish to address myself, however, was one of horrific consequences. Something no person, certainly not a woman such as myself, should ever have to endure. But first, to our arrival. As we studied the magnificent goings-on, the laborers with their shovels, the teamsters with their wagons, the supervisors working their crews with disciplined patience, for the hand laborers are almost entirely Chinese or Negro and need much supervision, I was struck by the military-like organization of it all. An easy analogy, given the sharp tongue of Williamson. This man, Williamson, was given to large bones and a massive head. He had a commanding presence. Shouting and gesticulating, he seemed to possess a language of hand signals known to all who worked for him, but especially those supervisors immediately his junior. He lorded from the porch of a rough-hewn shanty, calling names and then waving his arms like a frantic bird, directing deliveries, the removal of mud and dirt, and the efforts of the teams. Perhaps John's attendance contributed to this man's nerves, fixing him in an agitated state. Having not met Williamson previously, on this I cannot comment. However, I must tell you, dear diary, that on no terms would I have wished to be employed by Mr. Williamson on this day. His bilious, perfunctory tone carried clear across the construction site, often heard echoing right back at us, as if from the mouth of God. Not an insignificant reference, given the events to follow. Enough! John and I made our way to the edge of the giant pit and were witness to the first of the stones being laid for the Grand Home's foundation. This, as it turned out, was the cause of our delay these many weeks. John had wanted us to witness a momentous occasion, not simply a hole being dug into the earth. Although I must confess here that the hole alone would have surely impressed me as well. And there below us, a group of 10 or more Chinese ran, not walked, to and from a large pile of stone, inspecting every angle before running, not walking, that stone to a cutter, who smacked it with a hammer and chisel that rained stone chips in small showers all around him. From there, the stone was whisked to one of several Scottish-looking gentlemen. It was difficult to discern ancestry, given our perspective, who examined the rock, nodded his approval, and, applying mortar, positioned it in place. Stone by stone, the first of many of the Grand Home's walls began to grow, as the Scots worked as a team. I am told 7,000 stones will be used in the foundation alone. I found myself mesmerized by the sight. John, as I recall, had several conversations, but I scarcely heard his words. What beauty! It seemed almost alive to me, not as if it were being built, but instead growing all of its own. The thrill of witnessing this is hard to explain here in these pages. I found it consumed me, awakened a heat in me, not unlike what John Rimbauer is capable of with simply a touch or a whisper. Dare I say, I was moved by this. The pleasing fluidity, the sweating Chinamen, some bare-chested, flexing and glistening as they bore their burden. I could not take my eyes off of this activity. Not until, that is, Williamson's voice arose like an ill wind, cursing a string of profanities that forced such a blush on my part, my face must have looked like a ripened cherry. A large, overstocked wagon belonging to John stood in front of the foreman's shack, the driver equally as big as Mr. Williamson, and equally verbose. It was clear, even from a great distance, that Mr. Williamson did not approve of the quality of the items being delivered. I cannot tell you exactly how I discerned this. Distracted, even repulsed as I was by the language involved, but the conversation between them went something like this.
"This is not what we ordered, Mr. Corbin."
"This here is what I was told to deliver."
"You should have checked your damn load." I loaded this damn load, mister. I didn't have to check it, I loaded it. Look at this quality. It's horse shit. Pure horse shit. And you're telling me I'm supposed to use Mr. Rimbauer's money to pay for it? I would ask you to reconsider that position, sir.
I might add that this reference to John inclined me to believe that our presence there today may have influenced Mr. Williamson's response, as well as his aggressive nature.
I ain't reconsidering no damn position, and it ain't shit, and I'd thank you, sir, not to call it such. It is shit. It is the goods you ordered. These are them, right here in Mr. Rimbauer's wagon. Now sign the receipt, get your Chinamen to offload the wagon, and let me get out of this hellhole of a stinking construction site. Never seen so much yellow skin in one place, except maybe the railroad. And I don't like railroads. You will lose your job for those comments, sir. You will never be a teamster again with that attitude and that mouth of yours. You just wait until... Unload the goddamn wagon. I got me a date with a beer at the Merchant Cafe, and you're getting in the way of that, and that there is unsettling me a good deal. That there is what you want to do right now, mister. Unload the damn wagon, or prepare to eat some horseshit.
That's it. Enough of you. Turn this team around. Return the wagon. It's the last run you'll ever make.
I recall the teamster, Mr. Corbin, reaching into the back of John's wagon, beneath a tarp, almost as if he were digging for something. And then he turned toward Williamson. From a distance where I stood, I saw a puff of blue-gray smoke, like a tiny cloud. Then felt a punch in my stomach as a dull boom filled the air. Another small puff. Another boom. The first of these reports actually lifted Mr. Williamson off his feet. He looked as if someone had tied a rope to the back of his trousers, the other end to a horse, and then slapped that horse's behind. The second of the two shotgun blasts caught Mr. Williamson in the neck and face, a bloody spectacle so horrific that I was immediately sick to my stomach. He lay there on the porch, as still as a statue, rose-colored and dead. I'd never seen a dead person. I didn't know the effect it would have on one. The finality. The awareness that I, too, shall follow Mr. Williamson to that place. Heaven? Hell? I don't have the vocabulary. Those two offerings don't help me. I believed in heaven and hell before today. Now, I'm not convinced there are only two places, the black and white of afterlife. I'm of the opinion that gray must exist. Mr. Williamson convinced me. I can't imagine a man with that foul disposition in heaven, as I write. But what man who dies at the hands of another deserves hell? And what of Mr. Corbin? Where will the afterlife place him? Did I tell you where they found Mr. Corbin? At the Merchant Cafe, of course. His beer. They found him bent over that beer, nursing it. They say he didn't know where he was, or what he'd done. Didn't remember any of it. They say he must be crazy. Half out of his mind, John said to me. But of course, he means fully out of his mind. There are many of us walking around with only half a mind. They don't lock you away for that. You need to lose it all before they take you. And Mr. Corbin lost his. And they took him off. Off to jail, still wondering what it was he'd done. I've heard the term possessed before. I've heard it used as an explanation for someone half out of his mind. A Christian woman, I have never given such claim much weight. Possessed by what? I wondered. But, dare I write this, when writing seems so final an act? Now, I better understand the term. Now I am inclined to accept it. It pertains to the gray in the afterlife. It pertains to tragic people like our Mr. Corbin. Not empty, as half out of one's mind implies, but instead filled, but with the wrong element, the bad, evil. Filled with tainted fish, the stomach is already informed, but has not yet signaled the brain to retch. Filled with the gray, the other side. Possessed. Mr. Corbin was possessed. In this regard, who do we blame for the vicious act perpetrated upon poor Mr. Williamson? The possessed or the possessor? Was Mr. Corbin merely an instrument of the gray? It won't matter now. He'll never be back among us. He will hang. Possessed or not, he will hang. And he will die, legs twitching in the wind. The grand house will never be the same, of course. Mr. Williamson's blood is spilled upon the earth, is mixed with the mud and the mortar, is part of that place. And I can no longer think of it as I have. The blood is spilled. I saw it with my own eyes. Someplace between heaven and hell. Some color between black and white. And I find myself wanting a name for the place, seeing Mr. Williamson lying there. He can't have died at the grand house. He died someplace more lyrical than that. I will talk to John about this, for it is his house, but the color I remember so vividly is the color rose. Rose red. Blood thinned by a falling mist. On the way home in the car, John pulled off the road, came around, and opened my door. He apologized for all that had gone before us that day, as if we'd encountered a delay or bad service at a restaurant. I recall being amazed by his apparent indifference to the fate met by Mr. Williamson. He begged my forgiveness for the aggravation of that day, whereas I certainly bore him no blame for it whatsoever. Then he dropped his right knee into the mud, and I knew it was coming. And I must admit to both elation and revulsion. John is pragmatic. I told you that, didn't I? This was on his schedule, and he refused to allow a small murder to derail his plans. As he explained it, he regretted very much the events of that day, but his heart and passion would not allow another minute, not another second to pass, without voicing his intent. He asked for my hand in marriage. Clouded in rose. Clouded in gray. I am to be a wife. John's wife. For I quickly said yes. But truth be told, he picked the wrong day to ask, the wrong time. I'm quite surprised, in fact, that he could not see clear to delay this engagement. Even a day or two might have helped. And after so long, what difference is in a day? But there was a difference in John Rimbauer. I wonder if it took another man's death to create in him a desire to extend his lineage, or if one had nothing to do with the other. With life so seemingly fleeting, did he rush to judgment to marry? I feel certain we will discuss Mr. Williamson's demise for many months, even years to come. I believe that I saw in John a fascination with death.
I know that for me, dear diary, life will never be the same. I wonder where it is that Mr. Williamson has gone. Is there any return from there? So many unanswered questions. What, if anything, does John's hesitation to include me in his thoughts tell me about the upcoming marriage, this voyage on which I'm about to embark? How far, how smoothly, can this ship sail if captain and first mate are not sharing their thoughts? Are we doomed to the rocks? Or is there some lighthouse yet to be seen around the next spit of land? Captain, oh, captain. My breast swells with the thought of my marriage and all the new experience it will bring to me. I tingle head to toe. And yet my heart goes cold at the thought of John's carefully kept secrets and his refusal to let me in. He is so reluctant to share his thoughts. Will I ever gain entry? Or am I doomed to live in isolation despite our union? I fear this is how it's to be, and I dread the thought of a life spent in a lie. I dread the thought of this marriage as much as I am thrilled by it. August 18th, 1907, Seattle. As the future Mrs. John Rimbauer, it's the only plausible explanation for this, I was invited to join today an elite group of 23 women, led by Anna Herr Klees, to address a healthcare crisis in our great city, namely, the lack of a facility to treat crippled and hungry children. Over an extravagant lunch at Anna's home, we all agreed to contribute $20 each to launch the Children's Orthopedic Hospital. The press gave us great attention, both because of our sizable personal donations, John provided me the $20, thank God, and because our board is to consist entirely of women, unthinkable to the bankers downtown. I have subsequently invited all 22 of my fellow founders to our wedding this November, and expect all to attend. I can't imagine what it would be like to have a crippled child, and I hope and pray, yes, even to my darker God, that I shall never have to endure such a hardship. John and I plan on a large family, and I, for one, can't wait to get started. Though not without a great amount of nervousness do I approach my wedding night, quite afraid as I am of the actual physical union of our love. The idea of a man inside me both sickens and excites me. I wouldn't have bothered to even mention the fate at Anna's, except as a way to preface my anxiety over one Priscilla Schnubbly, a ferret of a woman with an exacting manner, pinched face, and scandalous tongue. Yes, I invited her and her husband to the wedding out of proper social intercourse. But my, how this woman vexes me! When I mentioned John, Priscilla Schnubbly snickered for all to hear. She then whispered into the ear of Tina Coleman, who blushed as rose as the spilled blood of Mr. Williamson, and went on to refuse to share with me the exchange that had transpired there between them. And yet I know, in my woman's heart, that whatever it was had to do with John and the rumors of his nighttime activities. Do I dare condemn John for actions taken prior to our marital union? Does such an eligible man owe me his chastity before we are officially wed? All these questions circulate in my mind, with me knowing nothing of the truth to begin with. Would I not prefer my future husband sow his oats prior to his promises than to break those promises later? Am I personally humiliated in social circles for his actions, as the snickering Priscilla Schnubbly would have me believe? Am I to be the laughingstock of Seattle's prominent women, because my husband may prove incapable of being a devoted husband? Am I willing to trade that for the wealth and privilege he is certain to bestow upon me? I am nearly dizzy with consideration. Consternation. Concern. Is John merely entertaining other women, or, heaven forbid, is he taking advantage of them? Was this the reason for the snickering? And why on earth do women like Tina Coleman think that their silence somehow protects me? Indeed, it does not. I have invited Tina to tea this very afternoon. We shall see. Tina Coleman is a gorgeous specimen of a woman. Tall, a brunette like myself, flaming blue eyes. I find myself quite taken by her beauty. She is the wife of an orthopedic surgeon, famous in these parts, and therefore a perfect board member for our new cause. She speaks slowly and calmly, and rarely moves her head left to right, as if her spine were fixed. We sat down to tea in my mother's parlor. Earl Grey tea was served with cucumber sandwiches and huckleberry scones. I recall our conversation vividly. "What a lovely home you have," Tina Coleman said. "I've lived here all my life. When I leave to marry John, it will be the first time out of this house, except for our family travels overseas, and 6 months I spent in finishing school in Brookline, Massachusetts, outside Boston." "I know Boston well," she said, maintaining her airs. "Tina, we've been raised in the same city, and had our parents shared the same circles, we might have been closer friends. I've known of you, of your beauty, of your fine manners, your intelligent speech, for many years, as I believe we were both courted by Jason Fine, that most peculiar, insolent man, who, in my opinion, will be lucky to ever find himself a wife." "Amen." When she sipped from her teacup, Tina Coleman's small finger raised in the air like a flag. I said something like, "I would have to have my head in the sand not to be aware of the rumors that circulate concerning the nightlife of John Rimbauer. You need not sugarcoat it, dear friend, but I do ask of you the truth as you know it, what you've heard, and how much credence and faith you put in these reports." "You find them vexing." "Indeed. Wouldn't any woman, especially one about to marry?" "Honestly, I don't know how you cope. I will tell you this. You have the respect of many of the finest women in this city, both because of your strength in light of the rumors you now mention, and because of your ability to win John Rimbauer's heart. Some women will envy you, Ellen, and you must be prepared for their vengeance. They will stop at nothing to see you fail. I would attribute a great deal of the rumor to this, and this alone." "But not all," I said. "John Rimbauer is a respected businessman, a man at the very peak of society. For me, or any others, to color him this way or that, without any first-hand knowledge, is undignified and without call. He is 20 years our senior, yours and mine. A man of the world. What are we to expect of him? That he spent these past 2 decades in a monastery? Clearly he did not. I would not trouble myself over his past. His future is with you, dear child. And a bright future, I should think. Very bright indeed. But you've heard things. Words is all. Words can be so destructive, especially when they are just so much fiction. But we don't know that. I don't know that, I said. I have been married 3 years. I have given birth to 2 children in that time. One lived, one did not. My husband is a brilliant surgeon, a fine man, and a loving husband. He does not always come home when he says he will. Sometimes it is with the smell of liquor on his clothes. Not perfume, thank God, but a woman's imagination can paint many a difficult picture, can it not? I love my husband, Ellen. He is not perfect. Neither am I. Neither is John Rimbauer. I'm certain of it. But these are challenging times. We live in a challenging part of the country. Some still refer to it as the frontier. Can you imagine? I trust my husband's love, even if at times I question his actions. Never to his face. Never aloud. A woman's heart is much stronger than a man's. They are weak creatures, dear. Weak, and often far more insecure than they present on the outside. Trust your love, child. The rest will follow. What is it you've heard? I asked. Are you listening? Yes, and I appreciate your sound advice more than I can tell you. But I simply must know what is being said behind my back, behind the back of my future husband. Or am I to be the laughingstock? There are women who can see the past, and some, even the future. Have you ever consulted such a medium, my child? A séance? They take all forms. I felt flushed with excitement. Have you ever consulted such a person? Oh, I do so regularly. Not always with my husband's knowledge, you understand. So you see, two can play at this game of carefully guarded secrets. I am trusting you not to betray our friendship and share any of this with John Rimbauer. Of course not. I felt giddy. A medium. I'd read news reports, but I had never met anyone who had actually attended such a séance. What can I expect from such an experience? Remarkable. Profound. Transcendental. You have never experienced anything quite like it. For all my heightened anticipation of the union of a husband and wife, I must admit to you now, dear friend, that I find a séance quite a good deal more stimulating. She showed her teeth when she laughed. She had gold work throughout. She appreciated her little joke more than I did, implying that I would be let down by the culmination of my forthcoming marriage, the anticipated union of which, only here in your pages, can I admit my honest excitement. Is it true the mediums can see to the other side? I do not know what to believe, but I imagine they can, yes. That is, I have experienced such a connection myself during a séance, and I must confess. I found her timidity provocative. She teased me with her reluctance to divulge all, begging my curiosity. I gripped my teacup with both hands and caught myself leaning into her every breath, wanting more. Yes? I think it far wiser for you to make your own estimations, dear friend. My experience? Well, you see, that is, I believe each of us. Either the connection with the other world is there or not. And for me it was, is. And as to whether it might be for you. But I know it is, I said, clearly startling her. My prayers are answered, you see.
Yes, well, prayers. There is more to the netherworld, dear friend, than one can possibly imagine. And it would be improper and wrong of me to imply it all has to do with angels and prayer. Some of what is revealed is most unpleasant. Not at all the stuff of prayers. She placed down her own cup and craned forward. When she spoke, it was less a voice than a cold wind, less a woman than a presence. The curtains behind me ruffled as if that window were open, which it was not. The crystal of the chandelier tinkled. I swear, the temperature of the room dropped a dozen or more degrees. I could see her breath as she spoke.
Many of the dead are still living. Whether you believe this or not, that is not my concern.
She waved her long fingers dismissively. She looked pale, almost gray.
One does not attempt to make contact with the other side without a certain, shall we say, personal investment.
A wry smile. She was consumed. I shuddered from the sudden cold, longing for a shawl or a throw over my shoulders.
One does not approach this lightly.
She leaned back. The curtain stopped moving, as did the chandelier. The color returned to her cheeks, and the temperature of the parlor was restored. I am certain I must have looked the idiot, my mouth sagging open in abject horror. For a minute, I swear to you, dear diary, Tina Coleman was not in that room. It was someone, something, else entirely. And I will also tell you this. I am a believer. Nothing in that room was of the world I know. Nor can I perceive that place from which it came. But I am fascinated and intrigued, as curious as a person can be about something so unknown. I wanted to ask her for the name of her medium right there and then, but something prevented me from doing so. Fear? Guilt? Was it John looking over my shoulder and cautioning me that
no wife of John Rimbauer will be found to be engaged in such sinful activities?
For I have no doubt as to its sinful nature. None whatsoever. God, whoever and however he may be, was nowhere to be found in that room this afternoon. And I would be lying if I did not admit to a certain amount of enthrallment, dare I say attraction, to whatever occupied my new friend for those brief few seconds. A power greater than any I have known. A power that both filled me with a numbing cold and an unspeakable heat that penetrated the depths of my soul. This is a friend I long to visit with once again. A power I yearn to feel again. To glimpse such a formidable presence is one thing. To taste it, to drink of it, yet another. To be owned by it. What must that be like? And how soon until I can find out? November 12th, 1907, Seattle. I am sitting in my mother's dressing room and parlor, a room in which I doubt my father has ever set foot. I am here, in front of the mirror, where for years I have watched her brush her red hair before bed. I am perplexed, and nearly in a state, some moments giddy, some pensive, some nearly in tears, clothed in my wedding gown, a garment at once both splendid and lush, yet fetching, or so I hope. My maid of honor, dear Penelope Strait,
has gone off to inspect the route of my descent to the front door, and the team of two black geldings who shall deliver me to the church in royal fashion. She said she would arrange tea to be delivered, and given this small break, this moment alone, it is to you, dear diary, that I now turn. I feel a bit like the young girlish child who once picked at daisies, reciting, "I love him, I love him not." Petal by petal, my poor heart labors over my decision to marry John Rimbauer. I feel both passion for John and reservation, cloaked as I am under the uncertainties that rise to the lips of my friends. The caution in their eyes that greets me whenever John's name is mentioned. I fear that in a very short time I am to marry a ladies' man. I am to be both pitied and scorned by my peers, and I shiver with the thought, "Deliver me from evil, and leadeth me not into temptation." Why do I find it so difficult to move on from these thoughts? Why do I weep now at my mother's mirror, knowing I shall never live in this home again? Following the reception, John and I are to take the presidential suite at the Grand, where we shall stay but a single night prior to our departure on the Ocean Star, bound for the Pacific Atolls. I am told the native women go bare-chested there, and the men wear loincloths, and the water is as clear as an old man's eyes. Much has been made in Europe about the changing face of fine art, and the influence these islands have had, and John would like to experience this part of the world firsthand. Oil is not used on the islands, and he claims he might consider starting a small business there. But these islands are said to be rustic, and quite taken to debauchery, and even open fornication. And I don't know whether to believe this or not. If true, what kind of a place is it for a woman? Why would John bring his new wife to such a place? And is this trip of ours to be made as husband and wife, or businessman and wife? I harbor all these questions, but I ask nothing of John, for it riles him so when I challenge his decisions. He takes it for criticism instead of the curiosity it is. And so more tears fall here upon your pages, for I know not what I have gotten myself into. Wealth, position, a darkly handsome man who has caught the eye of many an eligible girl, but 20 years my senior, moody and private. About our trip overseas, he has only told me to pack for a long trip, a year or more. Warmth, cold, prepare for it all. But where are we going, my dearest? To the islands first, as we've discussed. India, perhaps. Burma or Tibet, if we can find passage. The British have long since installed magnificent rail lines in this part of the world, and how far behind can an oil-burning locomotive be? I tell you, Ellen, Omicron is in a position to be an international supplier. We have the jump on the Far East because of our base here in Seattle, and after that, Persia. I'd like to see Persia. And then on to Africa, as the seas blow cold, and that continent warms with summer winds. East Africa, of course. Good hunting. And around the Cape, and up the coast to Spain, France, and Britain, if war doesn't prevent us. New York, Philadelphia, and then by rail again. Chicago, Denver, who's to know? The world is ours, my dear. 5-star. The best cabins, coaches, and the finest suites at the grandest hotels. Train cars all to ourselves. 6 months? A year? Long enough for the completion of the grand house, so that we have that magnificent structure to which to return. A place of our own. a place to raise the children that I hope you'll be carrying before our return. A family, Ellen, just think of it!
Said with such passion and enthusiasm, who was I to cut in with the voice of reason? To intrude upon my husband's shining moment? Never mind the insects that came to mind, the disease carried by every living creature in such places. Never mind the rumors of bare-breasted heathens. It seemed he had chosen only primitive locations. Never mind that I might have preferred San Francisco, Paris and London. A year in Paris, Venice or Rome. Now there was honeymoon. Long hours spent languishing in bed under a down comforter with room service a bell pull away. Hot bubble baths with Parisian soaps and my husband to guide me through the pleasures of being husband and wife. But for him, hunting. Natives, exploration, elephants, diamond mines, and the Iron Horse.
This ends Disc 1.